We're the fifth graders from David Douglas Tag Center. We listen to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, we'll feature an extended interview with the former progressive governor of Alabama. And we'll feature an encore broadcast of yesterday's interview with noted medical anthropologist and immigration expert Adrian Pine. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. We are always happy to have you along, and we are really delighted and honored to be joined by the former governor of Alabama, Don Siegelman. He was working in the government in this as a progressive in this government of Alabama for a long time. He was the Secretary of State from 1979 to 1987. He was the Lieutenant Governor from 1995 to 1999. Attorney General, 1987 to 1991. I'm overlapping something here. And the Governor, 1999 to 2003. Well, Governor, it is good to have you with us. It was wonderful to meet you yesterday on the election protection bulletin, and glad to have you with us today. I guess I want to read just a little bit of what the late Congressman John Lewis said about you. And it's all true as far as I'm concerned. Don Siegelman, Alabama's first progressive governor, advanced the cause of justice for African Americans and women, appointing more African Americans as judges than had been elected or appointed in Alabama's history. This drove Republicans crazy. The coup de grace was the governor's Siegelman was going to give free, get this, give free college education and free early learning to all Alabama children. And it goes on. Well, it seems as the progressive governor of a state, remember, before he was governor, it was Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. I guess he was named after Civil War generals. And this is a governor who couldn't even become a federal judge because of his out-of-control racism. And here comes the progressive Governor Siegelman to change some history in Alabama. Welcome, Governor. It is good to have you with us. First of all, tell us how the heck you could have gotten elected in Alabama. I was there. I spent only maybe 18 months investigating the way in which your former colleague, the former governor there, was turning church burnings into voter fraud investigation. So, you know, if you're a black person and you say your church is burned down, they come and investigate the fact that you're involved in voter fraud. I know that there were all kinds of horrible things that happened in Alabama around this. Anyway, welcome. How did you get elected? And then I want to talk a little bit about what you faced in the aftermath of extraordinary work and governing.
Well, first of all, thank you. Yeah, I had worked for Allard Lowenstein, a congressman who was elected from Long Island, New York.
He was my congressman. Yes, I remember. A real leftist.
Yeah, I was on the National Board of Americans for Democratic Action. I was a supporter of Robert Kennedy and Gene McCarthy's. I worked for Medgar Evers' brother, Charles, when he ran for governor, black man to run for governor of Mississippi. And then I faced off with George Wallace to battle for the control of the Alabama Democratic Party. He wanted to use the party as a springboard to run for to run again for president, and we were able to beat back his attempt to take over the party. But it took me about 5 or 6 years of hard work, going from county to county and city to city, building personal relationships with people before I was able to run and be elected Secretary of State. As you asked me how I was able to be elected, well, one, hard work, personal relationships, and two, when I got into office, I expanded the right to vote by increasing opportunities for people to register to vote and opportunities for people to vote. We allowed for deputy registrars, that any citizen could be a deputy registrar and register anybody they wanted to. We expanded the right to cast an absentee ballot so those same people could then take absentee applications to the people that they just registered. And we expanded the hours that polling places could remain open or should remain open. And as Attorney General, I settled a lawsuit which forced the redistricting and of cities and counties so that it made opportunities for thousands of black citizens to run and be elected to offices in cities and counties, and of course in the state legislature. So I made friends along the way. I'm amazed when I go down the street. It happened today. Two black men in different parts of the city stopped me and thanked me for my work as governor. But I'm going to try to make this short. But I championed causes like protecting children from abuse and women from domestic violence. And when I was governor, I brought in 5 automobile plants, including Honda and Toyota, Mercedes and Hyundai, and hundreds of suppliers. And we created over 1,000 new jobs. We made the largest land purchase in the United States for public use. We saved the Mobile Delta, which still is the most pristine delta in the United States. So I had a lot going, and I was relishing the thought of running against George W. Bush. And once that cat got out of the bag, that's when my troubles started. So, but that's how.
Right, you were definitely the perfect person to run for president from the South. A progressive, yes, but coming right out of the South, you were a real threat. And so, shall we say, Bush's brain, Karl Rove, was paying attention. You got the attention of some of the most powerful people in the country. And all that you've done, all that you did for the people was really not a positive when it came to Rove and Bush. Tell us how they dealt with you.
Well, it's interesting. The Kiplinger Letter, a National Business Journal, was touting me as a dark horse candidate in the fashion of Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, saying that I could breach the Republican stronghold on the South and electoral votes. And, I had written my speech to enter the Democratic primary in South Carolina. And my thought was, even if you know, I knew it was a long shot. Ray Davis was thinking about running at the time, and he was well ahead of me. And my national contacts told me that. And they just said, you know, just stay the course, and, you know, you'd make a good VP choice, so just hang in there. And so that's where my mindset was, you know, entering the primary and hopefully being, you know, put on the ticket as a VP. So when that article came out on March the 28th, 2001, the forces of Karl Rove descended on the state of Alabama, and it became an instant battleground. I was under investigation by the state attorney general, who coincidentally was Karl Rove's political client. I was brought to trial 1 month before the election by the U.S. attorney who was vetted by Rove, but whose husband was Bill Canary, who is a national Republican political operative. He was also Karl Rove's Alabama business partner. But the kicker was that while the U.S. attorney was investigating me, her husband, Bill Canary, who was Karl Rove's business partner, was running my opponent's campaign for governor against me. The judge I need to back up. So I was running for re-election in 2002, the night of the election. You know, after all I had done for the state of Alabama, I thought I would cruise into, home plate without getting any red clay on my pants. You know, I didn't intend to have to slide in. So the night of the election, I won, but after I went to sleep and after the poll workers had left and the poll watchers had been ushered out and the media had left the courthouse in a South Alabama county that was controlled by Republicans, the vote changed. I lost over 6,000 votes. But the kicker was that even though I had lost over 6,000 votes, not a single down ballot race was changed by a single digit. I filed for a recount the next morning, but before I could get down to this South Alabama county, the state attorney general, Karl Rove's client, seized the ballots, seized the voting machines, seized the cassette tapes, seized the optical scan machines, and took everything to Montgomery, and they have never been seen since. So I was thwarted in that attempt to get a recount, and then the attorney general, Karl Rove's client, participated in an illegal certification, illegal because it was done 2 days before Alabama law allowed for a certification. But I swore that I would, my comment was, okay, guys, y'all may have me this time, but I'm going to come back in 4 years and run against you. So that's when all the dust got stirred up, and I was tried by a judge with whom I'd had political conflicts for about 10 years. And it was Jack
Aiken. And they did have, you were in fact indicted right before the election, right? And you still, this the idea that everybody's worried about, you don't engage, you don't prosecute, you don't indict during 2 weeks before an election is supposed to take place. But I guess that didn't matter here.
It didn't apply in my case in the Bush administration. I was brought to trial 1 month before the election. One month before the election. And of course, It eroded my, it raised, when you're indicted, it just sends a message to people that something's wrong. And then when you're brought to trial, people don't have much, forgiveness. They think, well, there's got to be something here. And I forgot to mention the judge, we wanted to bring out the political motivation as a defense, and the judge refused to allow us to introduce evidence or testimony that had to do with political motivation. So even though the prosecutor's husband was running my opponent's campaign, And even though the Attorney General had started the investigation, state investigation, who was Scarborough's client, the judge wouldn't let us introduce any of that.
Now, the, shall we say, the ballot thief, wouldn't there be some kind of prosecution? You can't just steal a couple of thousand ballots and walk away with an election. There wasn't a law. I mean, what happened? Why would they be able to do this? Why would they be able to get away with this? Because it's Karl Rove?
Well, keep in mind that only 2 years earlier, Al Gore's election had been stolen. I say stolen because, you know, and it went from federal court to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, too bad, we're going to rule for Bush. And, you know, Alabama by this point was filled with Republican district court, and the appellate court was stacked. So we saw absolutely no hope through the courts. And first of all, we couldn't get into court because Alabama law requires that in order to contest an election, you have to have proof that there were enough legal votes cast to make a difference in the outcome. But because the Attorney General had stolen all the ballots and wouldn't give them to us, we couldn't make a prima facie case that I had won the election. So that's when, I decided I'm just going to fold my tent and run again, and that's what I did.
And that's when they came after you. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are speaking with the former governor of Alabama, Don Siegelman, and he was also the former lieutenant governor, secretary of state, and attorney general. An extraordinary feat for a progressive in Alabama. And I, with the greatest respect, governor, and I call you that advisedly, I come back to your success in terms of being able to be a progressive politician in a state that is known for its extreme right-wing politics. And again, I say, you came on the heels of Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, and he was named also advisedly for political belief. But I'm asking you now, I want to hear about your political genius and what you think could happen in the current situation, because right now there are about, I would say there are about 10 fuses lit, and violence could take the place of the next Democratic election.
Well, Dennis, I recognize that I was really coming on the heels of George Wallace, and I knew it was going to be. You know, I had to build bridges. I had to build bridges with the business community. My record, and as pointed out by the Kiplinger letter, because I had brought in so many automobile plants. I mean, what was kind of funny was that, and it was also one of my prized moments, was when Automotive News out of Detroit ran the pictures of the top 25 CEOs of automobile manufacturing plants around the country, and they had my picture in the very middle of it because I had landed more automobile plants than any other state or any other country during those 3.5 years. So, you know, I had a reputation of being able to work across the aisle, and I was able to get things done because, you know, like Joe Biden or LBJ, I'd been around, as you pointed out, maybe too long, but I'd been around as Secretary of State for 2 terms, Attorney General, Lieutenant Governor. And so I knew how government worked. I knew how to get things done. And we were just extraordinarily successful. And we had the largest road and bridge project. We started well over 1,000 new school construction projects. All of this was done in a 3-year period, and, you know, it was a massive influx of new jobs, and, you know, the state was looking good. So I was, you know, that's why I felt like I would easily win re-election. The one other thing I wanted to point out was Jack Abramoff, in his book Capital Punishment, and also in the documentary made about my case called Atticus versus the Architect, Jack Abramoff admitted that they funneled $20 million of Indian casino money into Alabama, and I'm going to quote him now, quote, to stop Sigelman, end of quotes, because, as he put it, I was an ongoing threat to their client. So,
wow.
You were right. I had Grover Norquist, Ralph Reed, all of those characters were in the state, including there was one person who eluded any attention, and that was the deputy political director working under Rove, who was in Alabama as Rove's bird dog during that time. And she was the one on election night who got in touch with the probate judge and said, if these votes stand for Sigelman, we're going to lose. And within 4 minutes after Kelly Robertson called Judge Johns, the probate judge in Baldwin County, a new set of returns were posted showing that I had, showing me with a little over 6,000 votes shy, and which threw the election ostensibly to my Republican opponent.
Listening to flashpoints on go on. Yes, please.
I just want to say this. You know, Trump's nonsense about losing the election is just that. But I do want to point out that elections can be stolen, and not just by Russians. So, you know, we need to have a verifiable way of looking at ballots after the election, to do an audit, to ensure the public that the election was fair. So, you know, I did want to make the point about Trump and his craziness. I know you've got to go ahead and take a break.
I actually want you to elaborate a little bit more on that. I wrote a book. One of the books I've written in this world is a book called Henry Hyde's Moral Universe. And I did in-depth investigations of the extreme right wing in this country. And I learned back then, in dealing with Hyde and the Hyde Amendment and all his maniacs, that we were dealing with a very dangerous and violent country. That's after I had gone through the South and investigated 120 church burnings. So I know black churches where people organize. You know all about this. So I have a sense of how violent this place can get. And then here comes Donald Trump, and he unleashes a certain level of, he sort of frees the extreme right wing to take actions that they've been wanting to take for a long time. So where do you think we are now? Has the Republican Party, for instance, been so infiltrated by the violent right that they're useless now? How does one pull this back and really guarantee that you can actually have a democracy and not, you know, another overthrow? Wouldn't you say we're in a very volatile, very critical moment in our history?
Absolutely. We are at a flashpoint, to use your name of your program.
Thank you.
It is a flashpoint. You know, having grown up in Alabama and having seen what George Wallace did, having seen the police on horseback, having seen police with gas masks gassing protesters, the water cannon, the police dogs, I never, you know, in church bombings, I never thought that I would see anything like that again. I thought this country had grown well beyond that, and until I saw Donald Trump, until I heard his comments about Mexicans and his attacks on Muslims and his defense of the right wing and his failure to move away from the Ku Klux Klan endorsement and the Confederate flag, you know, I never thought that I would live to see a return of Wallace. But it's worse than Wallace. It is more dangerous than Wallace, because now yes. we're seeing political clones of Donald Trump, like Ron DeSantis. I call him Ron DeSenseless, but he is a dangerous person. He is a dangerous person, and I think how do you get the genie back in the bottle? I think what we have to do I still believe that if we work long enough and hard enough, if we find the right candidates and we work for those candidates, we can get them elected. And if we can elect enough of them, we can make this country everything we know it can and should be.
Well, if you can do it in Alabama, if it can be done in Alabama, and it sort of reminds me of Studs Terkel writing about the way in which the early railroad organizers and unions saw the value of working together, black and white together, really making an alternative society. Bernie Sanders has talked about this beautifully. It would seem to me that you demonstrated in a state like Alabama that you can really bring people together. I mean, you paid a price for it in that the Rovites came after you, but you really, I think you made them very nervous, Governor.
The Republican Attorney General from Arizona, Grant Woods, his wife is a Democrat running for Congress this year, by the way, Marlene Woods. But Grant was a true American. He was the national co-chair of John McCain's presidential campaign. But he went on 60 Minutes with Scott Pelley and talking about my case. And he said that he personally believed that the reason I was targeted, because I was the one Democrat they could never get rid of. They could never get rid of fair and square.
Yes.
So I do think that there is hope. There is hope because I believe that we can find candidates that can bridge the gap, that can appeal to the right elements of the, and I don't mean far right, but the correct elements of the Republican Party.
Linguistics.
And bring just enough of those people on board to win the election. Now, I have to give credit to the black community in Alabama, because every time I ran, I got 96-97% of the black vote. So, I was the first, I don't know if I'm the only person yet since 1964 to be elected governor with a majority of both black and white voters, but I was able to do that. So it is something I'm proud of, and I hope that it could possibly serve as a model for others to replicate in other states.
Amazing. Amazing. I want to let people know that if they want to read about some about what we've been talking about, you wrote a book called Stealing Our Democracy, how the political assassination of a governor threatens our nation. It is worth reading, and you, sir, are really an example in a country where, you know, you got the kind of politician where, you know, you ask them a good question and they've got two good answers and three of them are lies. Politicians don't tell the truth anymore, and really what you do, what you've been able to do, the way in which you've been able to organize at the grassroots, it's an amazing example of a way to live, act in a world full of corrupt politicians that are really putting us in great danger. So really appreciate your courage. Any final comments, anything you want to tell the young people who might thinking about giving up on politics and but might be able to be convinced?
Absolutely. Just a quick note from Dr. Martin Luther King, who said that the arc of the moral universe is long but bends towards justice. And he stood in front of the Alabama Capitol and said that he was going to keep marching until the race baiters like George Wallace and now Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis, until they trembled away, until the justice rolled down like mighty waters, and until all of the children of this country were able to walk with dignity and honor on the streets of this country. All of that was centered around the right to vote. So we've got to protect the right to vote. We're at a critical point, a flashpoint with regard to the right to vote as well. So all of this means that we've just got to work longer and harder for our candidates. We've got to get them elected. We don't have a choice. Our democracy depends on us. It depends on what we do before Election Day to produce the results on Election Day that will make a difference, that will change our country, protect our democracy, and end the abuse of power.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you again. The book is Stealing Our Democracy. We've been speaking with former Governor Don Siegelman. He's also the former Lieutenant Governor, Attorney General, Secretary of State of Alabama. And we have a great deal of respect for you. Check this person's work out. Your courage is an inspiration. Stay safe, sir.
Thank you, Dennis.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine, and we are happy to come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over this marvelous, scrappy, no-holds-barred Truth to Power network. Coming up next, we want to play for you a segment we did last night on forced migration, immigration, with the extraordinary medical anthropologist, anthropologist Adrian Pine. Listen to this. Taking a deep look at the nature of immigration, forced migration, and the sort of the corruption and the corruption and the violence that now has come to surround what we call U.S. Immigration policy. These policies have led to all kinds of extraordinary suffering. I mean, for instance, we've reported extensively on what happens, the massive deportation of Haitians who left their country based on a failure of U.S. policy and a U.S. destabilization policy, forced back into the country by the thousands. And you can see that the Haitians, they won't even get off the plane once they land back in Port-au-Prince. They know, because the stories precede them about the kind of violence that Haitians are facing in deportation. That's just one horrific story of the terrible failure of U.S. immigration policy. And joining us to talk about this and sort of talk about regional policy, maybe from what it might look like if it mattered, if it was respectful of the needs of the region rather than Monroe, a doctor in times two. Adrian Pine, welcome to Flashpoints. I want to tell people that you're a medical anthropologist. You've previously taught at San Quentin State Prison, UC Berkeley, and American University in Washington, D.C. You retired from there 2021 as a associate professor, and you are, among other things, have written some nice books, co-editor of the Asylum for Sale, Profit and Protest in the Migration Industry. Good to have you back with us. Let's start with what do you think we're missing? We're not getting a lot of information. There were meetings by the South American presidents. I'm sure they have some thoughts about where U.S. foreign policy is going and what all this has to do with the future of migration policy. So could you sort of contextualize this? Help us get a frame for what's happening. It's certainly violent and terrible for the millions of people fleeing.
Sure. And thank you so much for having me again, Dennis. It's always great to be on the program. There's so much to talk about, both in terms of the South American Summit and, of course, in terms of migration. With migration, there's just so much going on right now, and it's all bad. The important thing to understand is that Biden has basically replaced all of Trump's policies with policies that mirror Trump's policies, and in some cases are worse. So we've gotten rid of Title 42, but instead Biden has implemented what asylum workers and asylum experts are calling an asylum ban, which effectively means what it sounds like. Biden calls it circumvention of lawful pathways, but he's circumscribed lawful what Biden is calling lawful pathways to such an extent that almost nobody can enter the United States, even to exercise their international right to seek refuge, to seek asylum. And so people are at the border. You've got, you know, really tens of thousands of people, some of whom have been waiting for many, many months. They're required to use this app called CBP-1 in order to merely request the privilege of coming to the border to ask for asylum without being jailed. This is something that goes against international law. The app is deeply flawed. It's only available in three languages, Spanish, English, and Haitian Creole. So anybody who doesn't speak one of those languages is basically screwed. And it also uses racist facial recognition technology, so it doesn't work on black people, basically. So there are all of these things. And then there are different restrictions for people from different countries. There's a parole program that the Biden administration implemented, which supposedly helps people from Haiti and Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua, except that it really only works for rich people. It works for people who have a passport. They have to also have a sponsor who's willing to pay for all their needs within the United States. They need to be able to fly. They need to be able to purchase a plane ticket to the United States and not come through the Mexican, through the southern border. So all of these things are really filtering for class. It's become really terrible. And one of the things, if we're looking at South America in particular, we do have a lot of migrants right now who are at the border, who are coming from Venezuela, they're coming from Colombia. And if you really get to the root of why people are coming from those countries, it has very little to do with the national governments and everything to do with U.S. policy, U.S. foreign policy toward those countries. So for Venezuela, for example, there was no net out migration in Venezuela. It was a migrant receiving country until 2015, which is when Obama implemented sanctions. And at this point, there are, I believe, around 900 sanctions, some insane amount of sanctions that the really? U.S. government has implemented against Venezuela. Yeah, 900 unilateral coercive measures. And what that has meant is that Venezuelans are suffering tremendous economic harm, which also has health consequences, and they're fleeing that U.S. economic warfare. And then because the United States uses them as propaganda in this game of regime change, you know, Venezuelans think, well, okay, we're going to get a good reception. But the fact is they are being treated just as terribly as everybody else on the border.
There's a couple of things I definitely want to get you to elaborate on, and we're going to take some time to talk about this stuff because the information you have is crucial, and I want people to understand more about what's going on. But it is correct to say that I consider it a bit diabolical that the Biden administration used the so-called cancellation of Title 42 and the pandemic restrictions to crack down. It became a major crackdown on immigration rights. Would that be a proper characterization?
Yeah, I agree with that characterization. Really, there's this idea. I mean, I think both parties, they're just trying to out-xenophobe each other, maybe to get the Florida vote for whenever the next presidential election is. But that's what we're seeing going on right now. So, you know, there's a sort of, it gets played out as a war between Republicans and Democrats, where Democrats think that it's actually the party that's respecting migrants because it doesn't say things like what Trump said about Mexicans being rapists and, you know, and wanting to build a wall, like the really explicitly sort of racist, xenophobic stuff that Trump said. But in fact, the policies of the Democratic Party have been just as awful, if not worse, in terms of numbers of deportation, the rate at which they are jailing migrants and criminalizing now. I mean, that's one thing that, going back to Title VIII, with the end of Title 42, what Title 42 did is it basically just, it bumped people back to Mexico, using this bogus excuse of public health. And this was a program that was implemented by Stephen Miller, who was President Trump's white supremacist advisor, as a way to just keep asylum seekers out of the country. But they were just bumped back. They weren't criminalized. They weren't entered, anything like that. But with Title VIII, which is what existed prior to Title 42, now migrants who present themselves at the border to try to seek asylum without having gone through this incredibly cumbersome and difficult metering system of the CBP-1 app to request permission. Those people are liable to be criminalized. They're liable to be thrown in jail. If they are deported, they're formally deported. It's illegal for them to re-enter within 5 years. So Democrats have gone to a system that is making it that is making migrants even more vulnerable than they were under Trump.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Adrienne Pine. She is a co-editor of the Asylum for Sale, Profit and Protest in the Migration Industry. She had an earlier book. Her first book was called Working Hard, Drinking Hard on Violence and Survival in Honduras. And she has done a great deal of teaching and spent a great deal of time on the ground. We met, I think, over a whatever was going on there, a U.S. supported subversion of the democratic government of Honduras, where you were living in the front line on the ground, and we've been following your work ever since. But talk to us, the presidents, the South American presidents, were meeting, I guess, yesterday or on Friday. I'm wondering what that dialogue would sound like, and how, you know, could you talk more about where Venezuela comes into this? Because it's confounding. On the one hand, you've got one of the most oil-rich countries in the world, and people are flooding. Maybe a third of the population is on the run.
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring up this summit last week. It's incredibly important, and it hasn't gotten the coverage here in the United States that that it deserves, and I think that is intentional, because what it represents really is South America coming together. All the countries of South, leaders from all the countries of South America met in Brazil, invited by President Lula, on May 30th, and then had meetings in the days surrounding that as well. And this is really the revival of UNASUR, which was a body, the United South American Nations, that was created by Hugo Chavez and a number of allied leftist governments in 2008, I believe. And it was created with the express intent of really pushing back against United States efforts at regime change and imposition of its agenda in South America. It was intended as a way for South American nations to collectively work together to assert their sovereignty and to achieve better situations for the people in those countries. And it really suffered between 2009 with the coup, the U.S. Supported coup against Honduras, and then multiple other U.S. supported coups in Paraguay, in Brazil, in Bolivia, in the following decade, UNASUR really sort of fell apart. A lot of the countries left. There was a different, very right-wing alliance that emerged. And now UNASUR has come back. All of these countries came together under President Lula's leadership in Brazil, and they had a very exciting and strong platform. And what this means for Venezuela, it's just impossible to overstate how important this is for Venezuela. I mean, first of all, it meant that Venezuela is once again has the strong support of all the South American nations. And I want to stress, even the right-wing South American nations came out with strong statements saying, yes, Venezuela's government is democratically elected, and Maduro is the legitimate president. And I have to say, I have witnessed Venezuelan elections. I have never seen that kind of transparency. And I've been an election witness in a number of different countries, in Honduras, and I certainly have seen U.S. elections. And it certainly merits the what the Carter Center said about it, which is that it has the most transparent elections in the world. And so for Venezuela to be lifted up by not just Brazil, but all of the countries in Central America, pushing back against the narrative from the United States, which somehow absurdly Washington still to this day, even after the Venezuelan Assembly very publicly and expressly expelled Juan Guaido from having any part in the opposition, Washington still insists that Juan Guaido, this clown who Washington basically appointed as the president of Venezuela in January of 2019, is president. So what you have now with this summit is the entire South America united saying no, you know, this intervention in Venezuela is harming all of us. Lula expressly saying trying to invite Venezuela to join BRICS, and this is incredibly important. BRICS is the coalition that includes Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. So Venezuela, and immediately, I think, I believe Russia and China extended their support for that invitation. This is creating just an incredible level of support for the sovereignty of nations that decide to take a different path from the neoliberal fascism that the United States is attempting to impose on countries around the world. They're also talking about a common currency for South America, like the euro, again, to assert sovereignty against the right-wing attacks from the United States against these countries. So it's a moment of tremendous hope for Venezuelans, that, you know, they once again will be able to, survive better from this vicious form of economic warfare that the United States is imposing on them, and for South Americans more generally, who will all benefit from this union.
Could you talk a little bit more, just sort of unpack a little bit more the phrase neoliberal fascism? What do you mean? I know that's a lot more than rhetoric to you. What does that mean? And help us understand how the United States still has the hemisphere in a stranglehold. We've got these nations that we're talking about, and the information you're sharing, which we never really hear in the corporate North American press. But how do we recover from this? How do we understand in a way that the people who watch the people coming up to the border understand, how the Americans understand why people are coming? Because until we understand the nature of U.S. foreign policy, destabilization policy, we're lost, right? We have a bunch of stenographers as corporate journalists, and it's not helping.
Yeah, certainly not.
I know that's a bit, I mean, but this is a struggle, this information. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go on, please. I'm sorry.
And I'm glad you ask about neoliberal fascism, because I actually use that term with a lot of thought. And that's because, you know, any ideal form that we refer to, whether we're talking about capitalism or Catholicism or I mean, in this case, fascism, is going to change over time, and it's going to be specific to the context that it's in. So if we look at the historic fascism, Spanish fascism wasn't the same as German fascism, wasn't exactly the same as Japanese fascism, but we see common characteristics. And what the argument of people, of those of us who are really proposing neoliberal fascism is that right now we're existing under a different economic regime than the one that powered classic fascism, and yet it is in many really important ways mirroring the structures of classical fascism. So what we see is incredibly sort of chauvinistic and imperialistic states, and of course especially the United States, which is the center of the unipolar center of empire in the world right now. We see a sort of militarism gone completely wild, a certain sort of corporatism with corporations really having power in lieu of any sort of democracy. And then, you know, there's also the sort of extreme kind of ideological stuff that we see that people tend to associate with the Republican Party and the followers of Trump. That's one thing, and that's, I would call that ideological fascism. But neoliberal fascism is when a state structurally replicates a lot of these classical fascist things through processes of neoliberalism. And neoliberalism is, of course, a sort of accelerated capitalism in which everything is becoming privatized, in which we've gotten rid of all of the regulations that protect labor, that protect our health, that protect the environment. And through doing that, you know, we've ended up with this kind of farce of democracy that's controlled by corporations that ends up mimicking fascism. So if you look at our police forces in the United States, they're entirely militarized. Our structures are incredibly racist, and yet it's not pushed forward through the kind of, we don't have a Mussolini state, you know, we don't have a Franco state, and yet all of these same processes are happening, and it's because our economy and our democracy have been entirely restructured to benefit the sole interests of capital, of the market as God. And so in effect, we end up having what looks a lot like fascism, in particular to people who have been historically oppressed and marginalized through racial capitalism in the United States. And, you know, and that's the quote unquote democracy that we're exporting around the world. So it's neoliberalism, the main mechanism for the exportation of neoliberalism, are international financial institutions like the World Bank, like the IMF, which oblige countries to get rid of all of the labor protections, all of the regulations that they have in return for getting loans. And so that's the mechanism for implementing what, in effect, prevents nations from exercising sovereignty, from exercising democratic decisions about how they would like to protect themselves. It's a complicated explanation, but that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the
we're happy to hear. We'll struggle with the complications. We just have a couple of minutes left, Adrian. I want you to talk a little bit about the implications. What are the impacts, and how is asylum used as a political weapon, and what are the multiple negative impacts from that?
Oh, asylum is entirely political, unfortunately. And in particular in this country, there are so many ways that it's political. You have judges that are political appointees, and so they are appointed precisely because they have a certain ideology. So if you look at asylum granting rates across the United States, and Syracuse University has a great program tracking this, what you see is that you'll have some judges who will deny 98% or 99% of asylum grantees simply because they are, you know, Trump appointees, or they're just xenophobic, right? But another thing that you see is that judges will systematically across the board grant asylum. They're more likely to grant asylum to countries that are sort of ideological enemies of the United States. So people from Venezuela are far more likely to get asylum, even though the asylum acceptance rate is so low. I think it's like 30%, but they're much more likely than people from Honduras. And I'm talking about when Honduras was living under a U.S.-supported narco-dictatorship of Juan Orlando Hernandez, who is currently being tried in the Southern District Court of New York for major drug trafficking and weapons charges. Hondurans, despite the fact that they were fleeing a narco-dictatorship, because Honduras was a U.S. ally, they were not receiving asylum. And that's because of the, it's because of U.S. foreign policy and judges, in the end, being, you know, ideologically, it being trained by the media, being, you know, appointed by. So there are the ways that I've just described that asylum is used as a political weapon, where, you know, it's really dependent on what judges' biases are. But then also right now, of course, what we're seeing is Republican governors in the South playing to their most xenophobic bases and making a big show of busing asylum seekers north to places like Washington, D.C., where I live, or New York City, and or Martha's Vineyard, and flying them to California, and, you know, sort of trying to turn it into this war of, well, it's all of you liberals in the North who want these migrants. Will you take them? And of course, Democratic governors are not much better than Republican governors, but they're not taking that stance. But what this really points to, and this is something that that Eric Adams, who I want to be clear, has not at all been welcoming to migrants, but he, as mayor of New York and governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, a couple weeks ago, held a press conference in which they were pointing out the fact that all of these migrants who have been bused and flown up to New York, if New York is really going to respond humanely to all of these migrants coming in, that the federal government needs to step up. This shouldn't be a state issue. We need to, and it also should be a political issue. The right to seek asylum is universal. It's international law. United States is a signatory to it. People have a right to seek asylum. And right now, the federal policy is dramatically hindering people's survival in states. It makes it incredibly difficult for people who come in and are seeking asylum to get work permits, for example, which means that they are going to be vulnerable to further violence, that they are going to not be able to find housing, they're not going to be able to legally find employment, they're going to be tremendously exploited, and so that renders them vulnerable to crime. And, you know, and meanwhile, you've got, again, people like Eric Adams complaining about this, you know, the migrants, and then talking about opening up old jails as quote-unquote housing. I mean, talking about opening up Rikers as a shelter. That's not a shelter, that's a jail. And, you know, and so really what we need are the Democrats, I don't know. But I don't really believe that the Democrats have any intention to treat migrants humanely. I mean, what we've seen from Kamala Harris, for example, who's been put in charge of telling Central Americans that they will not be welcome here. That was her first act abroad as she traveled to Guatemala and said, do not come to people who might seek asylum. So, you know, I don't really have any hope that Democrats are going to suddenly start caring about the human rights of asylum seekers who are fleeing their own policies. After all, Obama was the deporter in chief, with that he had deported more people than any other president to date. And Biden is continuing that legacy. But what we need to fight for, the ideal policy, I believe, would be one that would, you know, really sort of change some of these issues at a federal level so that governors wouldn't be able to politicize it in this absurd way where people who have already been so tremendously victimized by U.S. foreign policy are now being victimized by U.S. internal absurd, two-party battles.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
FM.
Goodbye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m. Next up is the bike show.
You need to turn on the mic in that room.
It takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal.